The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Deviant groups. I think we're also a center of early discussions in urban anthropology. Now, these early studies tended to focus on peoples whose occupations or whose lifestyles were sort of antisocial. People who were regarded as people groups regarded as illicit by the general dominant class standards. And special attention then in the 1960s and into the 70s was concentrated on the internal structure of groups like this. What were their normative patterns? How do we understand their lifestyles, their value systems? Mike there is thinking about doing some study on rock and roll culture, right? All right. That would be regarded in some sense, maybe not deviant, but it would be a very unique subclass that would be worth studying. How does the rock and roller see themselves in relationship to others? What does their world look like? Some of the studies during this time dealt with drug addicts, particularly Skid Row residents. There was a very famous book by an anthropologist by the name of James Spradley, and he did a study of drunks in prison. They were often, the place was drunk. When you're caught drunk on the street, you'd be put in a jail overnight called the drunk tank. And Spradley lived with those alcoholics on the street for about a year or so, and he learned their vocabulary. The book was called "You Owe Yourself a Drunk." And the book was published in 1970. Oh, there were studies of prostitutes. One of the studies I remember that gained a lot of attention was a book on the life of an ethnology of a cocktail waitress. What goes on when you work in a bar as a cocktail waitress? What about your relationships with others? How do you see the world? These kinds of studies were being done. Now, as I see it, Christian response to this area of interest has not been very strong. I've seen very little kind of study of these kinds of groups, probably because the groups seem too antisocial. They're usually thought to be resistant to evangelism. They're too strange to target as the objects of church planting. Now, in the past, in the 19th century, for example, the church in the United States took great interest in these kinds of groups. One of the most unique ministries was the ministry of the Skid Row Mission in American cities. When I was a student here in the 1950s, right down by what's now Chinatown was an area near the bridge, Benjamin Franklin Bridge, that used to be called the Tenderloin. And you go down there, and all along that area, which has now been all cleared away, you would find saloons, bars, and you'd find drunks all over. Then on almost every corner, there was a little gospel mission. And the mission provided preaching on the street, and then after you would have to, many of the Skid Row missions, you had to go to the preaching in order to get a slip to stay for the night, and then you'd be provided with overnight bed. The Westminster Seminary used to have, the students took charge of a monthly Skid Row mission down in Philadelphia. That's where I first met I took my first date with my wife. I took her to a Skid Row mission, and she married me anyway. But in those days, the church did do things like that. They had a ministry to these unique people, to addicts. The 19th century, there are some remarkable things done. Just reading some of the history now, some remarkable things done for women. And very sad that there was, I don't know what happened, but somewhere in the 20th century, there was a, it seemed like there was a, something happened, it was a crush, and women's ministries got lost. In the 19th century, for example, in New York City and in Chicago, there were large numbers of organizations that were set up to help prostitutes. And these were usually called things like ladies' aid groups and stuff like that. But they were provided for by funds by Christian women, reaching out to the women on the streets. And there was a very large movement. But somehow, as the 20th century, you moved into the 20th century, a lot of those movements disappeared. It's a very interesting history. There's a book by a professor at Bethel Theological Seminary, and it's just been reprinted by Baker Bookhouse. The author, professor's name is Norris Magnuson, and the book is called Salvation in the Slums, and it is the history of 19th and early 20th century relief movements in the inner cities of the United States, and it's a very beautiful just summary of what's being done. It concentrates, I think, on the Salvation Army, the Christian Missionary Alliance, and a couple of groups like that, but shows their very wide concern and interest in society. But somehow or other, though there were these activities, Christian research into the worldview of these cultures has been very, very minimal, and we still don't have it. These groups, I think, need to be recognized as unreached peoples. And as peoples whose worldviews are shaped, in this case, by things like addiction or deviant behavior. One of the things you'll be hearing from, for example, this week, and I hope you get a chance to hear this, John Freeman is speaking this week at our missions conference on Christian ministry to gays and lesbians. John is the director of a ministry called Harvest, operating out of 10th Presbyterian Church, ministry which the Lord has really blessed in all these years. John is John himself lived the gay lifestyle. He was a student here at Westminster, and I guess had not talked particularly about what he was had gone through. And he's told me this a couple of times. He was in one of our classes on missions, and I was talking about unreached peoples, just introducing the idea. And I said, you know, an unreached people doesn't have to be an ethnic group. It doesn't have to be a language group. It can be a group with an unusual lifestyle or with a worldview that sets it off from any others. And then I gave as an illustration the class. I said, gays and lesbians are unreached peoples. I said, how many evangelicals have committed the funds and the resources of the church to win gays and lesbians for Christ as an unreached people? Usually all we do is criticize the movements. Well, John came to me after that class, and he had never thought of that. Here was a new opportunity for him to face this challenge. But out of his commitments has come the ministry of Harvest, and it's well, well worth listening to. The Lord has blessed that ministry. But I think that would be an example of the kind of thing I'm talking about here. And, you know, what's our Christian responsibility? What about juvenile delinquents? This morning, if you heard chapel this morning, Bill Crispin gave his testimony about his experience and how God has called him to minister in cities. And I always enjoy listening to that one. And one of the things he mentioned, for example, that when he began ministering in Philadelphia, 1969, late 60s, 70, 71, gang activity was intense in Philadelphia. Gangs were literally going onto the public schools to recruit gang members. Did Bill say in 1971 that was something like over 140 young people were killed in gang activities in Philadelphia. That's an unreached people group. What's being done to reach gang activities. More recently, if you get a chance to buy that, there is a brother who is ministering in Chicago. His name is Mark Van Houten. And he's written two books now. The first one's called God's Inner City Address. And I think the second, I forget what the second one has, some little bit funnier title. But Mark is an evangelist. He is hired by what is called the Chicago Northside Ecumenical Night Ministry in Chicago. And his work, he's a graduate of Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And his work is to be a chaplain and evangelist to the teenage prostitutes, male and female, who run on the streets of Chicago. So his ministry begins at 10 o'clock at night, and he walks through the whole night. He'll finish up about 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. Visits the bars. He has several bars where he can stay. There are bartenders who refer patient customers to him when they think he needs to talk. He knows all the pimps and the prostitutes on the street. And these books are very powerful testimonies. He's trying to teach some theology, but he uses all of his experiences on the street to tell them. And for me, it's like reading a devotional book. The illustrations are so powerful. There are the kinds of books, too, that I think you'd get lots of things from to preach. Because almost everything he does, he tells with stories. That would be an example of a deviant group.
But can you hear his name on that book again?
God's Inner City Address, published by Zondervan. It's not a big thing. Maybe about 100 pages, I think, would. But very, very stimulating book. I think it's the kind of book that gets people stirred up.
His name?
Mark Van Houten. V-A-N, capital H-O-U-T-E-N. I think he's Irish. Yeah, that's right. I can see other areas like this. What about the world of the bikers? What are we doing to reach bikers for Christ? What about punk rockers? Don't we find in all of our cultures all kinds of groups like this that are just so far from us because they seem strange and out of touch?
Yeah. Recently I read the news that they open up a home for the AIDS people in Mount Amy area. And I also met a sister in the church. She's helping out a patient who is a gay dying of AIDS. He's about 40 years old. There's no one there to go in and help. But she's
doing it. I think that's a beautiful example of this thing. I think I've often thought, boy, isn't this a place, ministry to AIDS patients, isn't this a place where the Christian church ought to be setting the example? And yet you hear very little about Christians who are trying to develop a ministry like that.
But the reaction of the neighborhood is quite negative. They think they are against setting up such a home.
I'm encouraged. We have a student now who is just starting his doctor of ministry project. His name is from Columbus, Ohio. He's pastoring a pastor at a Grace Brethren Church. His name is Chip Hine. And Chip's project is to develop programs to encourage setting, they're calling them AIDS awareness seminars. And he's going to set up a seminar which he can run in all kinds of different churches for 2 days to get Christians to be aware of what this problem is and then to try and develop Christian ways to evangelize AIDS patients. That's a very exciting project, and I don't know of too many who've really even begun to think about that. But the Lord has blessed his ministry in Columbus as he's gotten involved in this. That would be another group like that. Well, these kinds of things, I think, are the agenda issues that urban anthropology dealt with in the 60s and 70s. These studies have their problems. I don't want to go into this in too much of a length because I want to go on, but you see, if you have this kind of problem-oriented research, it gets very, you can end up having a very narrow, unrealistic focus. Because these studies, these kinds of studies, neglect the lives and problems of mainstream groups of the city. Many of the problems they studied were not, in a sense, city-specific. The studies bypassed the actual issue of the city itself. And by concentrating on these deviant groups, by concentrating on issues like poverty, they often give the impression that cities are the center of all kinds of social problems. And then you feel very negative about cities. Let me mention one more. One of the last one, these are still dealing with agenda issues from the 60s and 70s. Topics more traditionally associated with cultural anthropology were also studied in the 60s and 70s. So you had this focus on peasants and cities, you had these problem-oriented studies, and then you had more traditional studies. I mean, this was the time, remember, of the origin of the urban anthropology. So it would be fairly natural to carry on the agenda of traditional studies. These studies centered on things like kinship systems, the process of socialization, the study of communities and neighborhoods. How does the kinship system function in the city? How does the ethnic group adapt to the city? The American Anthropological Association is generally a place where you can get an idea of the pulse of studies. And in Eames, in the book by Eames and Good, they mention on page 25 that in a mid-1970s meeting of the American Anthropological Association, the largest category of papers that were defined as urban dealt with ethnic groups. An indication, in fact, that's where continued interest was. Another center of discussion in this early period was the neighborhood. And I hope we're going to spend more time on this in class. How does the neighborhood as a community operate? How does a neighborhood affect the people who live in it? How do people function in a neighborhood? I have seen, well, we saw in the 12 years of living in the city, we saw some very striking differences take place in our neighborhood. The impact of drugs. And there's a difference between living in a neighborhood now in, let's say, an American city, and living in one 10 years ago. What is the difference? What's a neighborhood like? Now, I think that particularly is a very crucial issue for thinking about the church. You have to understand how a neighborhood operates. Where does a neighborhood end? What goes on inside to make up the neighborhood? Now, urban anthropology has criticized a lot of these studies that I've just mentioned to you now. This kind of research, the scholars have said, usually suffers from lack of real orientation to the city. More than one scholar has said, look, neighborhoods. Well, you can have neighborhoods anywhere. Neighborhoods in the country, neighborhoods in a village, neighborhoods in the small town, neighborhoods in the city. How are all these things, what makes neighborhood in a city different? And the scholars who did this research are saying, that this early analysis really didn't pay attention to that kind of factor. I think it's a good criticism. Neighborhoods in these studies became sort of like little villages, isolated little villages, and the studies were too narrow, too micro. So they didn't look at the neighborhood as part of the larger city. They didn't see the pattern of the whole. Now, recently this writing has changed in the last decade. And I think this is the area where Christian studies can benefit. The church, and once more, I think the Church Growth School has helped a great deal in this study. The Church Growth School has put tremendous emphasis on the part played by kinship relationships in church growth. Kinship ties are seen as very vital in understanding the flow of Christian conversion. Christian conversion flows along kinship lines. McGavran, in his earlier books, would talk about what he calls, quote, the web of human relationships. And he called these webs the bridges of God. He was very fond of pointing out, for example, in many parts of the world, here in the West, for example, in a white Anglo-Saxon family, our concept of the family is very, very limited. Nuclear family. Father, mother, the children, maybe grandparents, if we have any, and if they live close enough. But it's very tight, very small circle. Whereas in most parts of the world today, a family is a much, much larger, extended family idea. In the Korean language, how many words are there for family? There must be over 100, right? Very specialized vocabulary words for all the relationships in the family. Over 100. I always go crazy memorizing all those words. Well, how about Chinese? Same. Why? It's extended family. And the reason all those words are there, because every single part of that family is important to you. Because you have a connection with every single part of the network. I can remember a woman, we worked together, she was my secretary and translator for many, many years. And she's now a professor of Christian education in Seoul, at the Presbyterian Seminary. And when she first came to work for me, she just graduated from seminary. She was the first woman to graduate with highest honors in the class. We had to have a special faculty meeting because she was a woman. And the faculty was very embarrassed because they couldn't give this award to a man. I can remember the faculty meeting and we must have discussed it for an hour, and finally we decided that year we give two awards to first place and second place, so this woman could not get an award all alone. I don't know what we'd have done if the first two winners were both women. Probably half the faculty would have had to commit suicide. But anyway, she was a remarkable person, and when she came, she told me that she was the first Christian in her family to become a believer. And I didn't understand all of this then. And so I said, you mean your mother or father are not Christians? And she said, yes. But then she said, my whole family. And then she proceeded to give me all the names. And I was overwhelmed. But she knew them all. And with all of the names that she began to list, you know, all of her cousins, all of her second cousins, all of her cousins over here, all of her aunts, her uncles, in all of the web, she was the only Christian. She was the first one. And I remember 2 years ago meeting her, and she's since married, and she was so excited. And she started ticking off all the people now who were Christians in her family. But what McGavran is saying, you see, is that we use the web. And all along those lines of connections, you bring the gospel. That's what he means by the bridges of God. So So it's, I think what he's trying to do is pay attention to the idea of networking and kinship. Because it's along these sort of primary lines of connection, of social network, that the gospel is carried. And it goes through the clan, it goes through the tribe, it goes through the extended family unit. And it's like dropping a rock in a pool of water. And you watch as the ripples go out to the edge of the pool. And that's how people in extended family systems become believers.
Yeah, I know a church in Harrisburg, a Chinese church.
Uh-huh.
And majority of them come from two families, two surnames.
Uh-huh.
And they are intermarried, related.
Uh-huh.
And they continue to have their family members come out from Vietnam. And they go to the same place, same church.
Uh-huh.
So I found that in that church, I think more than half of the members, it's not a big church, so half of the members from that church are from these two families.
Two families, yeah. Boy. that's very true. Very true.
Yeah, I think the first generation, the first batch came out and then they saved enough money and then helped the others.
When the first batch came, Lim Sien,
yeah.
So there were Christians in that first group?
No. In fact, through a Bible study group, they came to know Jesus. So they can continue to attend that Bible study group. And then from that Bible study group, they developed the church.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when the other members of the family, when they came, then they heard the gospel through the family here.
Yeah. Yeah. They were not Christian before they came.
Yeah, right. But somebody in the family had already become Christian, so it went.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes.
But usually it's very difficult for the pastor this type of church, you know, because of the other relationship. If you're an outsider going to the church as a pastor, it's so difficult.
Boy.
So you must...
Back in my home church, there are a lot of churches, you know.
So you must...
Probably some of the family is dominant, you know. A great proportion of the church comes from.
No.
So well, that's work very closely with the family.
It's often, I think, I used to find in Korea, where in a small village, where you had a clan village, you would have, in the church, maybe one or two family names. Everybody was connected. But sometimes, if you had a clan village that was very tight, you would probably not find many at all. If all the Christians' names were Lee, none of the Paks would become Christian because of the conflict between the clans. Mm-hmm. That's also very strong. How do you do evangelism then? You start another Presbyterian church or Anglican church just for the Paks.
So first Presbyterian, second Presbyterian.
Yes, right. Pak Presbyterian, you could call it the Pak Memorial Presbyterian Church, and the other would be the Lee Memorial Presbyterian Church. Sometimes that's all you can do. You know, some of the struggles we're all having with ethnicity. We may talk about all of these theories, but when you get out there into the village and the city, that's the way it is.
Isn't that one of the reasons why, you know, organizational unity is so important? You know, so you talk about doctrine of the church, and that people will sort of naturally gravitate to where they feel most comfortable, but you know, there does need to be a visible expression of the unity of the church.
Yeah.
And
you know, McGarren and some of them who write talk about instances where whole tribes or clans come to Christ in one decision. That has always been so hard for me to even conceive of, being an American with our concept.
Yeah.
But they document it again and again. It happens where the leader says, okay, we will now accept Christ, and everybody does. The whole group. Just beyond my scope of understanding.
Lim Sien, you've had experience with that, though, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us some of your story?
I'd love to hear it.
Clan?
Yeah, where a whole clan comes to Christ at the same time.
It happens usually in the family, or they haven't come to Christ yet before. and somebody in the family member became Christians. And also, you know, maybe the Lord bless him. He's prospered both in business and other areas. So other clan members come closest to him for help. And also encourage them to come to church gradually, and that type of network is being built up. So they are being drawn to church. Yeah. So generally like that. It works through family.
Yeah.
And somebody married another clan, and then that the gospel go into another family, and then keep on looking that way.
We still see the implications in more recent church growth books and seminars, like Fuller Institute of Church Growth with Dr. Carl George. Talks about the meta-church model built on the cell groups, like Chose Church, and you know, a whole system which we're working on in our church, trying to change the paradigm to that. Yeah, it's tough, by the way. But one of the big points of there is that it has to be built on the small groups, the cell groups. And the biggest change I've seen in that over previous writing about small groups is he says there's only one way to make the small groups work. They have to be affinity groups. Mm-hmm. Use that word, affinity groups. So you select the leader, you train the leader, and then say, you go find people who are alike.
Yeah.
And you start your group.
Yeah.
So there's filtering right down into our society. Right.
Yeah, it's a homogeneous unity.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
How do you describe another group, like we don't like to use that, like primitive people, you know, they live in a village. Usually we take the chief as a target. Once the chief has been converted, there will be mass conversion.
Yeah. It's a lot of Dr. Tippett, who's has been a famous Christian anthropologist, usually uses the term animist group about a group like that. Instead of calling them primitive, he calls it an animistic culture. And that is very true. Animistic cultures, boy, people come all together.
I'm just thinking of the story of Jonah. The king says, we repent, and the whole city repents.
Yeah, right. The whole city gets on its knees.
Even the cattle.
There's, I think in the New Testament also, you find... thinking in the book of Acts, there are examples of you think of the Philippian jailer who became a believer, and we're told that his whole house accompanied him and was baptized. In the same chapter is the story of Lydia, and Lydia was became a believer, and we're told that her house followed her. I think the word house there probably means a great deal more than just children. I think it means her slaves, too. Because in the New Testament times, the house included everyone. So, I mean, they baptized slaves and handmaids and everybody else when Lydia became a Christian. The sis of them. At the same time, I think there's another one. There's something else to say about church growth, and I think it could be said here. In some of these areas, you've got strong, healthy emphasis by McGavern. At the same time, in some of these areas, there has been weakness in the research. What I mean is this. We're just basically underlining the need to expand studies in certain areas. Very little study, for example... Very little study has been done by Christians on the process of socialization. So if you've looked around, the discipline of cultural anthropology has been made very wide use of by Christian scholars now. And we have in our midst very committed Christians who are cultural anthropologists and wrestling seriously with how to use the insights of cultural anthropology in preaching Christ. I'll give you the names of three or four men that I consider outstanding in the field. So these are the kinds of people whose books you ought to have down. Charles Kraft, K-R-A-F-T, His brother Robert teaches at University of Pennsylvania, teaches in the religion department. Their theology is like night and day. Robert Kraft is a very radical New Testament theologian. Charles Kraft is a sort of a charismatic believer. Charles has probably the most important book that Kraft has written in this area is called Christianity in Cultures. Another very helpful anthropologist Christian is Paul Hiebert, H-I-E-B-E-R-T. He taught for many years at Fuller Theological Seminary, and last year is moved to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Chicago. He's now head of their missions department there. He's written two or three very, very fine books. I think there's one called, Missionary Use of Anthropology, something like that, published by Baker Bookhouse. Very, very helpful book. Another Christian anthropologist is Charles Taber, T-A-B-E-R. He hasn't written, most of his writing recently has been short pieces. He is an expert in linguistics and teaches at Milligan College in Tennessee. But for many years was associated with the United Bible Society. And one more name that may be new to you, Louis Luzbetek, L-U-Z-B-E-T-A-K. Luzbetek is a Roman Catholic. He's a member of the Society of the Sacred Word. I find him a very warm-hearted, evangelical Roman Catholic. I would commend his writing. Don't ask me how you can be that. I just know that he is. The book that I think is a very good standard, published by him maybe 20 years ago and just recently been reprinted, is called The Church and Cultures, published by Orbis Books. That is a very, very fine book. But I think these men are samples of those whom the Lord has given us who are working in this area as Christians. But by the same token, almost nothing has appeared in the area of sociology. These men are anthropologists. And I keep my eyes open, but trying to find a Christian writing in the area of sociology is very difficult. Or a Christian who's writing in the area of sociology with relationship to church planting, church growth.
What about Tony Campolo? He touches on some of the things, especially with related to youth.
Yeah,
culture.
Yeah. He may be helpful there. My sense, Woody, is that Tony's work is very limited. Like you say, he focuses a lot of his writing on youth. Has a lot of very helpful things to say about issues of poverty and the poor. That is a good reminder, though. It's not such a large area that he covers.
David Frazier, maybe, as well.
Yeah.
A little bit, but you're not talking about works like these.
No. Frazier has written more in the area of church strategy and all, but it's been very frustrating for me to look around to find Christians who are interested in church growth, church planting, and who are going to approach it from the point of view of sociology, urban sociology. Very, very few. Very little Christian research has gone into the process of socialization. And socialization as it affects church growth. There is a book published in 1985, written by David Philbeck, F-I-L-B-E-C-K. The book is called Social Context and Proclamation.
Is he a missionary in Thailand?
Yes, right.
Well, I know him, yeah.
Has he written
another
book?
He went to the college where I went. My dad taught him, yeah. I don't know what else he's written. I didn't know he'd written that.
Yeah, published by William Carey Library. And it is one of the first books that I have read specifically oriented to church growth by someone who has trying to use the discipline of sociology. He does not touch, or very little, if anything, on urban dimensions, but at least it's something. There was social context and proclamation. I think it tends to be more theoretical, but hopefully there'll be others to follow it. There's, you know, all these missing pieces, except for someone like Campolo. What's missing is almost any integration of these ideas with the city. Urbanism, as it affects church planting in the neighborhood, for example, empty. I can't point you to any kind of study. There are a number of very fine studies on the neighborhood, how the neighborhood works, but there is nothing on how the neighborhood works in terms of the church, and how to make use of that for the urban church. You're going to have to write those books. The best book I have read that tries to use some of the insights of church growth and tie them in with urban studies and sociology is a book by Keith Hinton, H-I-N-T-O-N. It's called Growing Churches, Singapore Style. It was published in 1985 when Hinton was a missionary in Singapore with OMF. I don't know, it may be OMF has their table out here. They may have a copy of that book. Go see Bill Wilson and tell him that I recommended highly this book, maybe give you a discount. This book is a beautiful piece of work. If I remember right, he wrote this as a doctoral dissertation at Fuller Seminary, and this was awarded the annual special prize for the best research in church growth. Hinton has left Singapore. Now he's professor at the Bible College of Victoria in Melbourne, in Australia. And I had a chance to meet him there this summer. But this is a fine piece of work. If you want a good example of how to weave the city into the study of church growth, and this, you couldn't ask for a better model for a book. But very little else since that time. Now, what I'd like to do now is get us started on the last piece. So far I have talked about the agenda of urban anthropology. Yes, Mr.
I like
to talk
about my neighborhood.
Please.
The only time when I came to America, it was not easy for me to find Spanish neighborhood. Radically Spanish population has grown up. I have upstairs Spanish neighborhood. I have downstairs Spanish neighborhood. I have next door Spanish neighborhood. One of the most characteristic in this time is they are living together. Ten family members, 20 family members. I can't imagine how they can live together in just one bedroom apartment.
One bedroom apartment.
But one of the most particular phenomena since Spanish population growing up is that Anglo-Saxon American or European American living in that area. And they blame their neighborhood. They condemn their neighborhood. And they think that kind of people, uneducated Spanish neighborhood and illegal Spanish immigrants make America quality, America lifestyle, America value system deteriorate. And I think it's a tension between American, Native American and Spanish neighborhood. But I feel more comfortable with the Spanish neighborhood.
Don't you feel it's sort of because in many ways the concepts of the family, you know, in a Hispanic family, it's a wide network, it's extended family. It's not like Anglo-Saxon, it's more like Korea.
But I think, you know, the increase of the Spanish population in inner city is a reality. We have to find the way to approach them. But we still keep very, very conservative attitude to them.
Yeah.
We cannot solve our problem in inner city. I think my neighborhood, I mean, my American neighborhood in the same apartment, who left my apartment, seemed to me very conservative, and I think they also deteriorate this country because they let Spanish neighborhood lost, isolated from the society. They cannot make any information in this society. Society is deteriorated. A lot of prostitutes, a lot of drug dealers.
Yeah.
But nobody concerned my Spanish neighborhood. Just Native American try to exodus from the inner city.
I always am amazed, you know, when I see those kinds of things happen, because you can't ask for a deeper, richer sense of the family and stability in the family than in Hispanic family. You may have a lot of trouble with young children, maybe children who have dropped out of school. But even then, there is a deep sense of the value of the family, a deep sense of being part of the family. And surely the family is one of the basic blocks of human society that God has ordained. When the family falls apart, our society will fall apart. What is so frightening then is to see people who make all kinds of judgments on very superficial grounds about those families. I'm impressed when I'm in the city and I work with black families particularly. The black family is undergoing more pressure today than I think it's ever faced in human history. You have drugs, you have all kinds of problems with the single parents. And yet, what amazes you is that the family is still there. The family still stands. It may be shifting, but it's still there, and it still maintains its balance and becomes the basis for the black culture itself. So I think we have to praise the Lord for all of that, and then we have to figure out, all right, how, given the fact that families are here to stay, no matter how they shift or change, how can we use them for the planting of the church? How can we see neighborhoods as rich places where the family has been at the center? Well, we'll move on next time.